Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things, the podcast we do after weird things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
And Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. Hey, can we start off? I just want to give a high five to Justin for recommending, is it The Squared Circle? Was that the name of the book?
Yeah, David Shoemaker's The Squared Circle, Life and Death in Professional Wrestling.
Yeah, I'm two-thirds of the way through it. It's read by R.C. Bray, the guy who read the Audible version of The Martian, and I'm enjoying it quite a bit. The first third was a lot of old-school history that I, you know, to me, it's just name of guy was the first to pioneer this aspect of wrestling that you're familiar with. But then, like, in the middle third is all my childhood. And it's like to understand the context of why, you know, Captain Lou was hanging out with Cyndi Lauper and all that stuff. It's great if harrowing stuff.
There's a chapter in there about race and wrestling that I feel like is among some of the best stuff I've ever written on that sport. And, this is a guy who really came to notoriety writing columns on Deadspin.com called Dead Wrestler of the Week.
Wow.
So spoiler alert, if you're not to the part where people are dying and these are all just a series of eulogies, buckle up because it gets pretty, pretty sad as you go in there. But no, it's great.
Justin.
Yeah.
What's the latest on your Kickstarter, your Project The Contender?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, Andrew, because we have, if you go to the Contender Twitter, you will see boxes rolling off the line here
in
Texas.
Wait, is that a Photoshop mark I see on the bunch?
No Photoshop. Although, just, you know, to tell a family secret, that was staged because all the boxes had been done. And by the time that I asked the guy to take pictures of them. So they did roll off that line.
Wow, what a favor that he did. Because that's so important to tell the full story, though. But it looks amazing.
He definitely went above and beyond. But yeah, you can see the boxes rolling off there. If everything goes according to plan, which, man, I'll tell you what, doing this has so much given me, not to say that I was ever really so much of this guy before, but if there was any element of me, of the why can't I have it now? They promised it was supposed to be released in March and now it's June. Why can't I have the thing I wanted? You know, it has been scrubbed out of me that as long as people are being responsible and letting you know, projections, you know, may or may not happen, you know, it is hard. And keeping those promises are difficult and expensive at times.
I wish we could have had a documentary crew following this through. That would have made a really – I think we're going to be seeing some cool documentaries coming out like we did about the startups, you know, of the 90s and early aughts and all that about, you know, following the Kickstarters, following these companies and seeing what happens and, you know, trying to relay to like my mom what you've been going through and other people like what's going through. I said, yes, it's, you know, it's this – they start off with, you know, you look at the numbers, you look at the table, you look at the timeline, and if everybody holds to their word – you can do this.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to be off. They can be the most sincere, but from your printer to the shipper or somebody off, and you have to account for that. But if you've never done it, how do you do that?
Well, and that's the thing is, right, you think you're giving a generous estimate for every phase of the entire thing, but you realize that any mistakes ratchet forward, you know? It's that someone just has to be one day late, and it shifts everybody else farther and farther back. I just went through the same thing with the release of the Arcana artifact and the Arcana decks. It absolutely slayed me that we ended up like, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks behind schedule on that. But you know, you put how long you think it has to be, and then you double it, and then you double it one more time. And that's realistically when it'll happen.
And it's very, very hard when you have people, and the three of us very much fit into this category, that are used to kind of controlling their own domain. You know, you're used to being able to say, you know, there's a reason why we've built studios in our houses and apartments, right? Because we want to be able to create a good looking product for which we can control, and we don't have to rent time, and we don't have to deal with the overhead of a network, and we don't have to deal with people taking a cut. Like, we are all very much do-it-yourself people, and taking advantage of all the abilities that are gifted to us now in this brilliant modern age. However, man, is it frustrating when you have to go ahead and deal with everybody for whom you are a frustration, because you're saying, you know, when things are out of their hands, you know, that you know, it's not for lack of an ability, or you know, that they're often late on stuff, or you know, things are hard to do, and yet you have to do this weird dance where, for all of us, every element of our partnerships that we've had, you know, for the contender, there's always a point where you have to be kind of firm but fair in every element. And that's from our, you know, from John and Megan Fawn, who we work with, you know, Guts and Glory for the design stuff. They're people that they work in their design company amongst all of us, each other. You know, this is, you know, for, you know, our printing partners and everything, everyone's got to be holding them accountable, and yet understanding that at times there's just going to be a delay. And then you don't want to cross that line of like, okay, so there's a delay. There's a problem. Somebody didn't get something done that they promised that they were going to get done. What is the line between, hey, we got to make sure this doesn't happen again, and you're damaging the relationship? Like, how hard do you push on that? How hard do you make, you know, and that's...
Well, and that's a two-way street,
element.
Too. That's a two-way street, because not only do you have to do that with your vendors, say, no, I made a promise and this has to go out in time. I need you to personally be there when that pallet arrives and push it in. And, you know, of course, damaging that relationship. But you're also caught in the middle, because you have a relationship with your audience, and they will understand. You know, you can bring them up to speed and show them pictures and say, like, here's where we're at. We're with, you know, we're telling you every step of the way. And as long as, you know, as long as it'll be there by Christmas, they'll be happy. Or as long as they're informed of the process, they'll be happy. As long as, you know, they see the steps along the way, they can be happy. But also, you're cashing in, you know, your good credit. Going back to what we talked about in Weird Things, that's your personal capital that's being withered away.
I think that underlines a very important idea, and that is you want to be transparent. You want to be on the surface as much as you can. And that's hard for some people, because, you know, like I respond to email from people or whatever. People will say on Twitter, like, hey, can I ask you a question? And, you know, as long as I'm not too weirded out, I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, email me. And then I'll respond. I'll get like, hey, thanks, whoever responded. I'm like, no, it's,
dude, it drives me nuts too, because people on the YouTube channel always say, hey, Scam School, why don't you do this for a change, you jerk? And then I'll respond like, I'm like, well, we didn't do it for this reason. Also, my name is Brian. And then the response is invariably like, oh, ha ha, I was making a joke. I was just testing to see if it was really you.
And yeah, it's like, and, but I mean, and I get, you know, I have these book plates, you know, that I offered for my Public Enemy Zero. I shipped those out. I was at the post office at, you know, 12 o'clock at night, you know, whatever, to go ship that out, because it shipped out. Because it's, for something like that, it's not practical for me to go. I got a lot of unemployed magician friends, you know, I could go get to go do stuff. But like that, I'm going to do it. It's me doing it, you know, and I don't try to hide and say, well, I'm going to have my assistant do this or my whatever, like, do that. Like, no, like I have no interest in pretending that I'm bigger or whatever than I am. I just don't. And that means dumb mistakes are going to be my own. I'd much rather be transparent. And part of it, though, gets into this thing where, you know, Brian, you dealt with this. I'm dealing with this. And Justin's getting into this, is that, you know, how much do you promote your stuff? How much are you out there talking about what you've got to do? And when you're trying to sell something, how do you balance that? How do you balance your social media between, hey, let me show you this genuine fun things that I'm doing and I'm up to, and, oh, by the way, I've got this thing I'm trying to sell, and make it very clear that, like, if you just like me because you like me, that's great. If you don't want to buy anything I ever produce, that's fine. Don't feel like when I'm pushing something or whatever.
But that's tough, because part of the reason people follow you is because they want to follow your genuine story. And oftentimes what you're most excited about, you there are times you would be doing a considerable disservice to your fans to not mention the fact that the new Jessica Blackwood novel's out, or that you wrote an amazing novella, you know, in 24 hours.
But that's part of your, you know, all the work that goes into that happens before you plug something. Right. And you building up a genuine relationship with your audience and to the point where they know it, you know, it's I got into this, not an argument, but, you know, a conversation that is not quite appropriate for this show, but, you know, about voting. Right. And because of my steadfast belief that you are totally cool if you don't want to vote. In fact, you're cooler than people that pressure other people into voting because you need to do it. And part of what my larger point with that is that if you are really genuinely enamored with and want to make progress on whatever your cause is, all that work that needs to happen is not election day, right? Like everything that you want to do to advance your cause happens before. Every other day is more valuable to that cause than election day for you to go ahead and spread the word and become an important part of whatever you want, okay? This is just like that. You need to have an understanding with your audience that you are a certain kind of person, that you are ambitious, that you care about stuff, that you're not going to rip them off, that that this is something that you know, they might be qualified to care about. And then you can plug it because they've been on this journey with you, right? But where people get, I think, caught up is when it's like, oh, no, there's zero communication, and then a plug, right? And every time you hear from somebody, it's a plug. And I think that you know, ultimately the product is what people care about, you know, because there's a lot of comedians that only, or actors that only tweet whenever they have a show or a movie or something out, and we don't begrudge them because we like their shows and movies.
Because we perceive it as content. Like when Dan Carlin tweets out new Hardcore History episode out, number of people upset by that plug, that call to action, is exactly donut, because we only get them three or four times a year. And when they do, it's like Christmas.
But they're also, they're quote gifts too, though, because they're free.
Yeah. Yeah. But even if they were, you know, even if he were to charge, I mean, I'm sure he sees a surge in sales as a result, but let's say they were 99 cents and we only got them three times a year. If we were just as excited, like, you know, if let's say you only tweeted whenever you had a new ebook out, I think we would be just as excited for that, whether we were paying for it or not.
I think it depends on the audience. I think that's part of it too, is you build audiences and people come to you from different places. You know, I've new followers from India because Don't Trust Andrew Main is airing on like History 18 there. So, you know, that's interesting now as I'm getting people, this is this new thing for them. And then, oh, you write books too? I'm like, well, yeah. Aren't you the largest English speaking country in the world? Cause maybe. I think it's helpful to hear you guys explain that, you know, and to talk about like, how do you find that balance? And one of the things that when I was at Disneyland, I shared so many photos and stuff I was doing, because one, it was cool and I'm always fearful of oversharing. But the other part is like, yeah, it's just I want people to know that like I had a lot of stuff coming out, you know, this last couple of months, because I've just been in this create space tear, and I've had a couple side projects that all of a sudden materialized all at once. I'm like, man, I can't have everything be, hey, buy this. You know?
And I find myself understand if you can't provide content in your social feeds, and I think most of us are Twitter centric because it appeals to our, you know, our busy schedules and the fact that we could just, you know, fire something off. You can provide value as a content curator, which means, you know, it's almost kind of like a job to, you know, just go through the blogs, the usual suspects, and see if there's something that leaps out at you, kind of like you do, Andrew, for the Weird List.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that, because that's just a fun way to share it. And the Weird List, the people respond to that certainly. Like our open rate on the Weird List is 50%, which is really, really high. But on Twitter, like I love Twitter. As I get people, I love Twitter because I find it to be far more conversational. It is far easier for anybody to dip into that conversation to say, hey, look, he just said this, let me respond to that. I don't have to worry that, you know, everybody who follows me has the opportunity to see my post versus Facebook, where they have to specifically say, show me all their posts, whatever. You know, comment threads, things like that. I just find Twitter is I love it. And I respond to like 99% of my at replies because it's not that hard to do. And it's become, you know, it's a very even platform in that regard.
So I think that there is something to be said, though, that like there's different playbooks for everything. And really the point is, you know, to yourself, be true, whoever you are. If you are not a super talkative person and you are not a somebody who thirsts for that kind of engagement, there's plenty of other ways that you can engage with people. I think, you know, obviously, you know, Brian and I certainly, you know, have kind of made this sort of a monastic commitment to sharing every detail of our lives, you know, whether or not people want to hear it. You know, if you look at like some of the content on the albums and everything.
Oh, dude, that is our going to confessional. It's like everything we do that's embarrassing or shameful, we know that we're going to have an accounting for because we'll have to share it with the world.
But I mean, that's not everybody. And everybody isn't, you know, someone where it's like I think we all three of us can put out 80% other content and 20% of the other of that can be either directly or indirectly a plug for something that we make money on, right? But that's also a kind of ever-shifting goalpost because you don't quite know. You know, these days it's like there's so much kind of microtransactionally that it's like when I tweeted last week that like my mom supported my Patreon. And so now she's giving me $3 a week again. And the last time she gave me $3 a week, I had to clean the bathroom in my room. you know? So, like, is that me plugging my Patreon? Is that me bringing awareness to people that I have a Patreon and people can support it? Maybe, you know? You know, there was somebody that a potty decided to ask me what my Patreon URL was, but it's like, or is that a funny tweet? You know, like that, those lines are so blurred now where it's like, you know, if I say, hey, I'm stressed out and, I want to fall over with excitement because people are going to actually get to play the full 500 card deck of the contender next week or the week after. Like, is that me plugging that at thecontender.us you can pre-order or buy this game or that is shipping now? Yeah. Is it true? Yeah. But only the context for that.
Wait, what does the government say about that, Justin?
I'll save that for Tuesday. John Stossel on the Weird Things podcast. You denied me. I mean, it's so hard. It's different, you know, and people, the more that you give of yourself, whatever yourself is, the more that you give people a roadmap, the more they'll follow it.
Yeah. And I think there's just sort of an honesty. You know, it's one of those, it comes through in all of your tweets and all of your posts when your true interest is figuring out what's in it for them. If that guides your writing, then people will not mind that, you know, along the way they acknowledge like, oh yeah, this is a way to support this person and allow them to make money.
Well, and you know, there's parts of it for me where it's like, I think we all know people that are just salesmen, right? That are just people that are constantly thinking, how can I be smart at engaging the audience, right? And if it's smart or funny or interesting, then like, and you still know, oh, he's wants me to get into this funnel that at the end gives up money. Like you still kind of have an element of like, hey, that's really rad. Like, you know, like, cause we know it, we know who he is. Like I would rather have somebody, an honest person who is like, I want to sell stuff, you know, than somebody that it feels like, oh no, I'm your friend. And here's a thing I want to give you. That's really got strings on it.
And I think that you can wear different hats. When I get a scam stuff email, I know I'm getting this is I'm getting this email because I know that Brian's got really cool stuff and I want him to tell me about this cool thing. You know, when I watch Night Attack, you know, that's a different thing. You know, I know that, oh, okay, you know, this is I know if they're going to push something, it's going to be funny or for a purpose or whatever. I'll tell you what gets to me a little bit, though, is that, like, I don't spend a lot of time in Facebook, but I've had a couple of people like, oh, yeah, I'm on Facebook, and I follow them on Facebook, and then I see some kind of interesting post and a reply, and I see they're not active there, and then I realize, oh, this is all pushed from Twitter. And it's like, oh, you're not even here. You're just pushing your stuff here because you want us to be aware of you, but you're not responding to people in the space, which, you know, and I try to be conscious of, like, when am I doing that? And I know people who are kind of sincere people, but it's like, now you're kind of giving a middle finger to people when you just push these things through every single platform and you don't pay attention to what's going on, because it becomes this,
oh man,
you know.
I had to learn that the hard way, because, you know, there's a different way to act on Facebook than acting on Twitter. And I once had my Twitter and my Facebook connected, and boy, did it annoy everybody on Facebook that I was tweeting these, like, tiny little, missives or many times three or four of them in a row. And it was just dominating their newsfeed. It is, it's a different tribe, man. It's a different language spoken, and you got to figure out what it is.
Yeah,
and I see people who are, like, in entertainment or getting involved there, and, you know, you inevitably have they sit you down with whatever network or studio or publisher or whatever, and you meet with two women who are going to be in their mid 20s, who, you know, just, you know, go to all the seminars, and they're going to tell you about how you need to be super active and what you need to do and how you can do this stuff, and most of the advice is good advice. But also people all of a sudden feel like, man, I got to catch up. I got to go do this. And often they make some bad mistakes that they don't realize, you know, that are damaging later on, rather than taking, you know, it's taken me forever to figure out, where am I comfortable on Twitter? And you know, what's funny is, like, I have discussions with people who are like, you know, people don't get sarcasm on the internet. I'm like, I've maybe had one tweet that I ever felt, or two tweets that I ever felt that I had to explain, but I didn't bother explaining. It's because I know I'm shouting to a room, and I've got to play towards all sides of it.
I worry less about that. The times I've been dinged on sarcasm not translating on the internet are when somebody has tried to be funny, but just flatly written an insult to me. And I've written semi-defensively, and it has caused, you know, a moment that I wish I could get in a time machine and handle another way. So I think it's less on your end, and more on, or at least in my case, you know, in the reading of other people's posts.
But that also goes back to that thing you were saying before, where someone just says, "Hey, you're fat and dumb," and then you're like, "Whoa, why'd you call me that?" They're like, "Haha, LOL, you caught my joke."
Like, yeah.
You know,
I'm an extremely sarcastic person in person, you know, person. I mean, I'm very, very.
Oh, really?
Very, no, Brian, I actually am. It may be hard to know, but yeah. In a way that, like, I don't even have to use the tone to be sarcastic, believe it or not. So for me, you know, how do I, there's a way I talk on Twitter, you know, and the way I talk on Twitter is the idea of, somebody's kind of squinting and sort of half reads this, they're still going to understand or get the context of it. And I'll rewrite stuff that'll be like, oh, you know, I can see how somebody will misinterpret that. And, you know, when you've got hundreds of thousands of people who can potentially see what you're saying, you want to be careful. But I don't feel like I'm censoring myself. I just understand that, you know, if I'm going to go walk in and do a magic show and I see a 5-year-old there and I see a bunch of hipsters there and I see an old lady there, I'm going to play to everybody.
Yeah. So is there somebody that you can think of that really knows how to play? Because I'll admit, out of all the social networks, Facebook is the most challenging for me, because there's such a expectation of interactivity, but also you have the most present of gatekeepers between you and your own freaking audience. Is there something what do you guys know about success on Facebook that I could learn from? Because right now, the only thing I know this is, post native videos on Facebook. They love the hell out of them because they're trying to take on YouTube. And out of everything I've done in the last, like, 4 months, the instantly freeze of beer video we posted natively, and boom, no asking for a boost post, just all of a sudden, like, hey, 11,000 people of the 30,000 people saw it instantly.
Yeah, I found that on your advice, like, I did that. Like, I flipped through the pages of my book, Magic and Mischief, available at andrewmain.com, click on shop. I flipped through the pages of the book, and Facebook, and immediately it got 6,000 views. Whatever 6,000 views really mean.
Well, on Facebook, and of course, yeah, that is the problem, is that 6,000 views is totally bogus because it counts as a view. Just then, that was a view, even though there was no audio and we only got 4 seconds into the video on the live feed. That's a view.
And I meant like the post got that, but yeah, there was 3,000 actual views, which meant 2 seconds or more were But yes, I totally believe that they're pushing this in front of a lot of people. I don't know. I don't – like, you know, I go to the Magic Castle. Remember the Magic Castle? And I go to this Friday lunch, and then a lot of times the topic is whatever is being discussed on the Magic Castle Facebook page. And people are like, oh, what do you think of this? I said, I don't go. Like, well, what do you mean? Like, every time I hear it come up, it's because there's a controversy. There's some argument or something that somebody said this and somebody did that. I said, there is no time in my life for that, number one. I don't have the time for that. Two, this is a negative thing. This is not the people who are most present are the most angry, and I find that in just about any place.
Plus, also,
why would I be there?
I mean, you're almost guaranteed that it's exactly four people involved in this whole thing.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, you know. I mean, it's funny because, like, I know a magician who got upset with another one of these magic discussion boards who's decided to start his own. I'm like, you're going to have your flavor of problems. And I see no value in that at all, because it's everybody with megaphones and nobody listening.
Yeah.
Well, and there is, you know, a questionable element of, like, and you see this with Reddit, you know, I'll read regularly their wrestling forum, their most popular wrestling forum and their most popular Hearthstone forum. And it's like, you just start to see the cycle of, like, popular thought upvoted, right? Whatever the popular thought of the moment is, you know, and then reaction to popular thought. That gets upvoted or downvoted, or it's upvoted because they're getting downvoted. Then there's the post about, hey, how everybody is all circle J-ing, right? And then it's like, oh, that gets upvoted. But then it gets downvoted because, no, but we're really right. And there we go. Like, it is just like this back and forth. It could be 40-60 opinion split, and everyone just keeps yelling. You find whatever the common denominator arguments are that are as diametrically opposed as possible. And you just kind of bounce it back and forth, and that's online discussion. But maybe that's all discussion, and we just, you know, focus on our own granular little element of it, and that's why we think that it can be more complex.
I think that, you know, somebody has mentioned the whole idea of the hive mind, and I avoid the comments in a lot of places because, you know, one is, you kind of sometimes don't want to know who else is reading this, and you might agree on some things and disagree on other things. And then you see things like, you know, all too many times I'll see somebody point out a cogent, interesting counterpoint and just watch it get downvoted.
Just
because,
buried. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody there has this alternate political or philosophical point of view or whatever. And they don't want to hear that. They don't want to know that. And we're big believers here that, you know, our mantra, guys, for all listeners out there, is, you need to be able to intelligently articulate an alternate point of view to the point that those other people would say, yes, that accurately reflects what I think.
The ideological Turing test is the greatest philosophical construct I've run across in the last 10 years.
I hate that term for it, though.
Why? Right. Why? No, I love it. The moment I read it, I instantly got it. I know what a Turing test is, and an ideological Turing test is perfect. It's perfect.
You got two big words in there. It's like trying to explain, like, type 1 and type 2 errors. You know, it's like
that was a little more challenging. But unlike type 1 and type 2 errors, the nature of it is inherent in the title. I like ideological Turing test. Yeah. But I've tried to.
I hate it, and I think that you should stop downvoting me. I think the greatest. If I could have my druthers, I would love to have either like internet or television series where you get some of the loudest mouthpieces in our popular culture and put them in a debate against people that would consider themselves on the other side of an argument, but they had to win a debate, and maybe you had like charity money or something tied to it, you know, arguing the other side. Yeah, I would love to see all that charisma understand that there is a wide variety of thought in the world.
You know, I agree. And the problem is that that, you know, one of the reasons why kind of like we talk about, like, we don't trust people who go to rallies, you know, or, you know, champion, you know, people they believe, because to be part of that, you do not want, you have to run those organizations, to run that sort of thing. You have to keep your group from being exposed to alternate points of view. You don't want them being exposed to these things because, one, you're letting them use their cognitive capacity, and you're running the risk of, well, maybe we're going to lose people here. It's more advantageous to say, no, don't consider it. It's stupid. We figured it out.
Right.
To encourage people to have an alternate point of view.
Basically, once there's a profit motive, when the more polarized there are, the less listening they do, the more money your entity makes, that opens the doors to a lot of problem.
I would love, like you said, John, that would be great. That'd be absolutely great. And that's one of the things, like, I've always been, you know, I'm in any organization, why I've had problems with just like organized skepticism is our ability to apply that skepticism to ourselves is extremely problematic. I could find numerous examples of how we don't do this, and then you bring that up, like, yeah, but we've got a greater cause here. No, our cause is truth. Or truth. Truth is our ultimate cause, and when we say we're going to sacrifice that, or that, or we talk like maybe we need to be more persuasive and appeal to people's emotions more than anything else. If you're sacrificing truth to do that, you lost. You help the other side win their battle.
And I totally lost my train of thought. But I think, you know, there's absolutely, you know, there's such a need for that.
You guys want to swerve into picks real quick?
I just real quick on the subject of Kickstarter. I got something in the mail the other day, and I burst out laughing uncontrollably. I had a fit in my car because I opened up an envelope, and there I found.
Oh, my God. I was wondering where my coin is. I saw that they're selling it on Amazon, and I was like, didn't I give those assholes money like 3 years ago?
It was – when did they first – the coin was first 2013, so it was 2 years ago.
Okay, 2 years ago, but still
– two iPhones ago.
Oh, my God.
And so finally I got my coin.
Just in time for chip and pin technology to render.
Oh, I know. It. Now my cards are chip and pin. I'm like, I don't know where I'll be able to use this now.
Yeah. Man, that's amazing. I look forward to mine as well. We'll see.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, maybe at some point. And, you know, maybe I'll enjoy it on my generation ship.
Yeah.
I hand it to my son and their his daughter.
In my mind, I would love for Justin to be defensive, like, hey, guys, they worked really hard on that. And there were production capabilities circumstances.
That is my greatest, I have no sympathy, like, considering that, like, they have, and I get why, I understand the decisions they made, but at some point they decided, hey, look, we are going to continue to roll on as a business before we take care of the people that had faith in us first. And that, to me, is, that is a fundamental problem. And we're in that situation now. We could turn on our Amazon page right now, and we could sell it, or we could say, hey, Black Friday. The contenders now on sale for cheaper than it would be otherwise, right? Or cheaper than they sold it on Kickstarter. We could. That's a thing we could do. If we wanted to prioritize our future business over the people that gave us money early, we are not going to do that because it's a terrible thing to do. And I don't want to coin this thing.
This week there was news about, remember the Zano or the Zano little mini drone?
No, I don't. Oh, wait, like a micro drone or something?
Yeah, it was a micro drone that was like, I remember when I saw this thing on Kickstarter, I'm like, oh, this looks really cool that it can follow you around and stuff. I'm like, oh, it's only like 250. I'm like, I don't trust this. They're not going to deliver this. This ain't going to happen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and guess what? It's like, you know what? Like, this thing kind of like, I believe, like, a lot of these Kickstarters are started by people who've got some engineering background and are really good at, you know, we can put together a prototype, have zero experience in, one, I mean, scaling, two, people. You know.
These guys can't be as bad as the Solar Roadways people, right?
I think
they were selling mugs. They were selling mugs with an idea in them. Fill your mug with this hot idea we're pouring for you.
Fair enough.
So – My argument with the Solar Roadways people is they just didn't know any better, technically speaking. It's just like, well, why don't we do, you know, oh, listen, water's got hydrogen, you know, and the people who were telling, who were sending me the solar roadways thing, I'm like, oh God, do I, you know, so I think that anyhow, I think that, this thing's hard. Kickstarter's hard. And,
oh, it's rough. And you know, there are two things that I was very excited about that I backed recently. One was like the ultimate travel jacket, which I'm going to get probably a solid 6 months after I stop professionally traveling. And these Cocoon headphones that are really, really great for sleeping on planes as soon as I stop flying on planes all the time. But I got an email from the Cocoon, which, you know, all the great stages of Kickstarter. Have an idea. Create a video. List it on Kickstarter. Get funded. Send your first enthusiastic production delay. Send your second enthusiastic production delay. Bump your, you know, it's like, and so we got the email for everybody who backed the Cocoon project that like, hey, guess what? We really want to make it as great as it can be. And it turns out we figured out a lot about how to make it, but we got to bump this back until another. And it's like, man, you look at everything they're doing. You look at their offices. You look at like, oh, wow, it's a lot of, you know, here's business 101. Delays aren't just delays. Delays are, you got to pay everybody's salary. You got to pay that rent on the building. You got to pay for, you know, everything that you thought was going to cost X amount of money now might cost more. It's insane. And now it's like, all right, well, hopefully on the other end, the travel jacket, they were upfront and they're like, hey, good. Guess what? We're a huge success. We are going out of pocket to start investing in this stuff right now to get the production line moving before our Kickstarter ends. You know, so we're going to float money to do it. And it's like, I look at that and I'm like, okay, these guys understand how to get a product from point A to point B. I look at the Cocoon thing and it's like, now you're worrying about the noise canceling app or whatever? Like, that should have been something that could have all been done before you even listed this Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I remember, I'm looking through my Kickstarter page of all the stuff that is yet to materialize. Remember the Air VR, the VR glasses, for the iPhone.
Oh, wow. Like a Google Cardboard kind of thing.
Yeah, there it is. So, I'm looking at that, and that was estimated delivery December last year.
Oh, wow.
But there's an update. They say, hey, we're starting to ship. You know, we've got our final beta.
Well, you realize July. You know what's funny is now we're seeing the invention of financial vehicles to circumvent federal restrictions. You know, there's a lot of speculative, and you know whether this is good or bad depends a little bit on your political philosophy. But you know, back after the great crash, they instituted these things saying like only qualified investors, people who have $250,000 to blow at a drop, are allowed to invest in non-accredited investments. And now what they've done is they've created these virtual investment vehicles that allow everyone to kick in a few bucks and become kind of a virtually accredited investor.
Didn't the SEC just rule on that?
I don't know. Did they say good or not good?
Or somebody was just telling me that they have relaxed the rules on like the $1 million in the bank thing.
It looks like we're seeing a
new SEC rules set limits on crowdfunding investments.
October. That's 2 weeks ago. Interesting. Well, hey, real quick, regarding picks, did I make my pick last week, How to Fly a Horse? Did I already say that one?
You've picked that before, but I did it
months ago, but I definitely want to double down on it again. I am so surprised at how much more I got out of it on my second listening of it. It was so good. I started reaching out to other author friends of mine, just begging them to, I bought a couple of copies for friends. It's amazing. It's so quotable. It is. It's called How to Fly a Horse, The Secret History of Creation, Invention, and Discovery by Kevin Ashton, who's an Austin resident as well. The audiobook is read by the author. He's got this rich British voice And it's filled with so much science, so much interesting analysis of the evolution of creativity. It's so good. I will say right now, you know how much I love The Rational Optimist and Abundance. I put it right up there. It's if you're a creative person, if you're somebody looking to figure out how to learn more about the world and develop more ideas, it's a very, very practical guide of saying, guess what? Creativity is very, very boring. It's a matter of just doing and reiterating or iteration. It's amazing.
I'm curious to read that, because I know that that's sort of like a thing that Steve Johnson's talked about, I think, in his book, The History of Everything. And then Matt Ridley talks about the evolution of everything. And I don't know enough, but I know that I have seen a meta problem with some of the examples brought up, where there are certain things which a certain stage which you're just going to have numerous iterations, but then you're going to have people who are going to think very, very long about a certain solution before, you know, because we have this like the inevitability. We get like certain things are inevitable, but there's a certain point where there's so many layers of complexity. You need to have somebody spend 10 years or some
right
10 years trying to solve this problem.
Well, the main thesis of the book is sort of a rejection of the Mozart hypothesis. There was some biography of Mozart that falsely quoted him as saying, you know, oh, I just think about music for a really long time, and then I sit down and boom, it all comes out fully formed. And he never said that. That never happened. If you look at his work, it's highly iterative. And he goes on to he points out to Kandinsky, if you look at painting with white border, there's a couple of versions of it. And in the earlier versions of it, they've now used X-rays to go down and see the six or seven layers that have been painted over as he reworked it. And he practiced making this one painting. And then they also ran X-rays on his final version. And on his final version, he never goes back. He never changes a stroke. It's clear the entire thing is practiced and rehearsed to where he was able to do it on this one sheet one time, because he had done it or versions of it a million times before. And he already knew in advance what he was going to do. He doesn't overstate it, but I don't know. Read it. I think you guys will like it quite a bit.
How to fly a horse?
How to fly a horse?
Yeah, I keep hovering over it, and I read the description, some of the stuff, and then I kind of, for some reason, I was kind of like, I don't know, you know.
I'll give you. We'll make it a $5 bet. If you don't like it, I'll give you $5.
Ooh.
Five whole dollars.
My pick is $5. It's a bill. You had his Abraham Lincoln on it. Is it for almost any?
Well, let me quickly, because one of the things I've heard is like, you know, like, and again, not having read the book, like with the Wright brothers and the airplane, is you talk like, oh, all these other people were building the airplane, but the Wright brothers are the ones that had to stop and go build their own wind tunnels because they realized that all of the math was wrong and nobody was going to fly until they solved those problems, and it gets
right. Correct. And then, you know, he's also got a great section on the nature of writer's block. And he does a lot of really good quotes from Woody Allen, who says there's no such thing as writer's block. There's only the inability to write stuff that you like. And if you hit that block and you can't write stuff you like, well, then the obvious answer is write stuff you don't like, write stuff that you hate and get started, and then make it an iterative process to turn it into something good.
Okay. Cool.
What about you guys? Oh, you already said yours, right, Justin?
Sure. I don't remember, but I'm sure it was awesome.
I can do more plugs of my own
bills?
Stuff. And
oh,
take $5 away
bills.
Your pick.
That's what you said.
$5 bills.
I remember.
Number one pick. Today.
Sorry.
Get them at the Fed.
You want to know what? I have a plug. I don't know what everybody's doing on Thanksgiving. But me and my lovely wife, Ashley Paramore, are going to be hanging out with anybody who wants to on Twitch. We're doing a big 8-hour live stream where we are going to cook a full Thanksgiving dinner. It's going to be super fun. You know, we had the wedding this year, so we saw everybody in our family and went east a bunch of times. So we just decided to skip Thanksgiving and Christmas on the East Coast, which is a first for us. But what we wanted to do was bring that celebration to share it with everybody on the internet. So check it out. It'll be on my channel. I'll host it there, twitch.tv/jurystone, and on her channel, of course, twitch.tv/fakegamergirl.
My pick is I just watched this movie again. I watched, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, which I love to go watch every year and, you know, watch it like, you know, 20-minute installments, you know, spread across several nights. Lawrence of Arabia is great. It's on Netflix. And that got me thinking about desert movies and stuff. And so I watched Flight of the Phoenix, the original Flight of the Phoenix, which, if you're not familiar with the film, it was remade with Dennis Quaid. And I don't think the new version was as good or compelling as the original, which is not always the case. Like, you know, I thought that like 6:10 to Yuma, the new version is really, really compelling, whatever. But anyhow, the original Flight of the Phoenix, 1965 film, and it stars James Stewart, Ernest Borgnine, and you get a bunch of other, you know, Richard Attenborough is basically the co-star of it. And this was directed by Robert Aldrich, who also directed such films as The Dirty Dozen and some really cool kind of war movies. But
this is where they got to build a plane out of pieces of another broken plane.
So what happens is oil workers are middle of the desert, you know, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, area, whatever, trying to leave, and they get caught in a windstorm and they crash in the middle of the desert. And the odds of survival are slim and none. And the only person on there who has a plan is this German who says, well, we can take this plane, take our crashed plane, and make a new plane and take off from there. Hmm. And it's a tale of survival and ingenuity and trying to, you know, survive. So
very
it's kind of neat. You know, it's a very kind of contained story. And you look at, too, like movies back then, I would say that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they used to be much more ensemble-based. And there was a really good Freakonomics podcast which talked about suspense and when, you know, and how reversals, or excuse me, what they would call twists and stuff, and how you people can sometimes be conditioned to predict things. And they do it. They make a very rather dismissive statement that, like, oh, when superheroes fight, you know, they're cliched now, or blah blah blah, and there's no surprise. And I'd argue, like, well, it's not so much the surprise isn't who wins, it's how they win. And that's a thing I think that's misunderstood about a lot of genres, is that people go, well, we always know who wins. Yeah, but it's not about who wins, it's how they get there. You know, there's always one of two consequent, you know. Anyhow, I digress. Point is, it's a, you know, interesting ensemble piece, and it's sort of a really neat classic story of survival and aircraft engineering.
Right on.
Still sticking to $5.
$5 foot long is another thing you can buy with $5.
Gentlemen, anything else?
No, it's been after.
It has been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.